me pones un ejemplo. Entonces, si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Jizz Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Jizz Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. You know, a disengaged teenager is one who shows a lack of interest or motivation in school, social activities, or personal goals. This teenager is often withdrawn from meaningful participation in their immediate environment. Meet Rebecca Winthrop. She's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. Her research focuses on global education, emphasizing the skills young people need to succeed in work, life, and as active citizens. Rebecca works to advance quality and relevant education, exploring innovations and leveraging family and community engagement to accelerate progress. She advises governments, international institutions, foundations, civil society organizations, and corporations on the issues of education. Today, we learn about Rebecca and her new book she co-wrote with Jenny Anderson, The Disengaged Teen, Helping Kids Learn Better, Feel Better, and Live Better. Let's walk today with Rebecca on her plight as she helps us unpack the learning modes of our children and really break through for the disengaged teenager. Rebecca, welcome to our show.
Wonderful to be here, Jules. Thanks for having me.
So excited. As you all know, we've been playing tag all over the place, but I'm most excited for this show because we have so many things in common, our fight against education. Can you please start us off? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in this work. Tell us about your journey and your walk.
Wow, yep. Okay, my journey, how did I get involved in education? Well, it was a couple of experiences that I had as a young person. I got the chance when I went to college to go to Central America on a study abroad program. And it was an incredible experience. And I worked in a banana plantation. I was really focused on environmental change and climate change and the environmental movement. And this was a banana plantation that the United Fruit Company, which is, for those who know about Central America, I was in Costa Rica, is a big company that produced a lot of bananas and you know, basically killed the earth with all their pesticides and didn't give their workers much support. So they would pay them a salary, and then they would take back money for rent and take back money for their kids to go to school and take back money for healthcare. So they were, you know, pretty stuck there. And then one day the United Fruit Company left. They said, oh, we're not making any more money. And they just left all the workers behind. And these workers were trying to form a cooperative, a workers cooperative, to do organic farming. And they wanted an intern to help. And I went down and I was terrible. I was trying to pack bananas and I messed everything up for a day. I was terrible. I couldn't do it. It's super hard because you have to get the banana racing. You have to in seconds. People who work in in banana production are incredibly skilled and so smart. In seconds, they could weigh in their hand to the tenth of an ounce how much a banana chunk weighed. And then they would just pack it in a box, and it had to be the exact right ounces each box, and it had to fit. And then they would ship it on, and I couldn't do any of it. I was terrible. So they booted me to the front office, and they said, you know, they were nice. This is really, you don't really have any skills, but you can read and write, and a lot of us can't, and can you help us? So that was one experience I had, and I had several experiences like that, and it just opened my eyes to what it means to not be able to read and write. And it makes your world very, very small. And these are brilliant, brilliant people. Your level of literacy is not related to your brilliance or your wisdom. And that just set me on my journey to work in education for everybody who doesn't have access.
I think you're the first person I've met who was terrible at a job and gets promoted in the very same day.
I was really terrible. I really messed up there. Yeah, it was awful. So embarrassing. Anyways.
Beautiful. You know, when you and I began to chat before, just online and making our, you know, connection, we started talking about different ways to keep people inspired. And I know that you focus your career on education and really trying to talk about, just like you just shared, the marginalized children and youth. What has inspired you to do this work and to be so passionate about it?
I have been inspired on this journey. I told this story of the banana workers. I also had an incredible experience working with women refugees in Central America who were in really difficult situations. They were in situations of domestic violence, and they were just so savvy and smart and so determined, because I was working with the UN at the time and trying to pass. I was very low on the totem poles. I was assisting. The project was to pass legislation to protect women from domestic violence. And they said, that's nice. That's nice. But that is going to take a while to pass. And then you have to train the police. And it's going to be a couple years before, again, we get access to education that we need so we can start our own business. They wanted financial literacy so we can start our own business and actually be the author of our own lives. We're trapped in really difficult situations. And so they were so determined. And if you, that inspires me every day, them and every kid who either can't go to school or is in a school situation, is in a school that doesn't see their gifts, doesn't see their, what they can contribute, doesn't lift them up. And again, I don't blame teachers for this. I'm pretty clear on that. And I would imagine you don't either. Whoop. But that's what has inspired me.
Can you talk about the role of engagement in the lives of our teenagers, and why is that like important beyond academics?
Yeah, that is something that I have gotten more and more appreciation for, the role of motivation and engagement in school and in learning. Ever since COVID, really, when I saw my own kids, I have two boys. When in the US we went in home online school, and school went pass fail, and one of my kids, who was really, you know, motivated to get good grades, lost all motivation entirely. So he was motivated not to learn the content. He was motivated to get the good grades and feel good. And my other son, who was really struggling in school, he was dyslexic and a couple grade levels behind, had just gotten diagnosed. He was in third grade at the time, and really internalized that he was stupid because he wasn't able to read and keep up with the others. He blossomed in COVID. I thought he was really disengaged, and he was. But he just needed a new environment without having to keep pace with all his peers. and he blossomed and caught up to grade levels and is super engaged in his learning. And so that right there shows you if you're not motivated and engaged inside in what you want to learn, you're probably not going to learn it. And that's also what all the research shows, that how engaged you are is important in any context, at home with your family or caregivers, if parents are trying to help kids to, you know, learn something or be better people or take life lessons, with friends, in technology, with teachers inside the classroom. If kids are not engaged in that experience, nothing's going to come out the other side. They're not going to have increased knowledge. They're not going to have increased skills. They're not going to have increased competence. And so engagement is actually, it's essential. It's central to learning in any context.
Mm. You know, interesting that you share, and thank you for your transparency, just modeling for us here once again as the teacher you are. Interesting that you share one of your sons, highly motivated, before the pandemic hits. All of a sudden the pandemic hits, it's like, okay, you done messed up my structure, and now I don't know what is going on. And then your second son, who you were like, oh no, I'm really going to be in trouble, to some degree still was disengaged, but felt that the change slowed it up a bit, that he was able to feel powerful or confident enough to move in that way. Tell us more about the pandemic, because we often talk about it, but I want to talk about, besides the personal side of it, the global education landscape. How did it impact, especially the students and the communities of need?
So I think the pandemic was really, really hard on families and kids in particular. And those things go together. The harder it was on caregivers and families, mm-hmm. the harder it's going to be on children. And in the U.S., most schools were closed for a very long time, a year more. My kids were home online learning for a year and a half, mm-hmm. Which it is an impoverished form of learning as it was delivered, because schools were not prepared to do online learning. It's very, very different to do good quality online learning. You need a different scope and sequence, a different curriculum. I mean, it's a whole different thing. It can be done, but it's a whole different thing. Around the world, you had some schools that reopened relatively quickly. Some schools didn't close at all for kids in need.
Mm.
Let me repeat, some schools never closed at all for kids in need. There were schools in Europe that if you were a kid and you had frontline workers in your family, if your parents had to go to work in order to get food, if you didn't have enough money to meet your basic needs, if you needed extra help, you got to keep going to school. Just a small group got the care and sustenance, because schools provide a lot of things, not just cognitive instruction. Mm-hmm. And then slowly kids came back after that. So some places were a lot more savvy about the potential risks. It didn't even increase, actually, I don't think, markedly COVID spread. And then some places globally were closed for years, like 2 years, more than 2 years, and not 2 years online school at home. I'm thinking of Uganda, 2 years, no school, no school, 2 years, all schools shut down, no school, basically. And you just think about those kids' trajectory, especially adolescents who probably are not going to come, I know, aren't coming back in the same numbers once school reopened. And it was a real, real blow to their educational trajectory.
You know, funny enough, you kind of provide for us an opportunity to like look at this at a slower pace, like in real time. For me, there were pieces, just like you said, that the pandemic alerted us, at least here in the US, to the importance of social development. Mm-hmm. I also saw the importance of what school really meant, because now you had parents having to homeschool kids mm-hmm. while still trying to put food on the table and provide for their families. And I guess the push here was more of the marketing aspect, that we can stand up and fight back and be ready. But what we noticed when schools did open, we were still playing catch up. And for scholars such as your own, who were out a year and a half, you're talking about a student who probably was in sixth grade and was going to high school right after.
Yep. Went back middle of seventh grade. Had one more year, middle school before high school.
Can you talk about some of the ways that programs or strategies of these programs can bring significant success when such a halt, if ever we had COVID again, or something like that happens? What can we do that we can learn from that this second time around?
Yeah. So what could we do differently if we had a pandemic next month is a bit of your question. Yeah. I think we have learned a lot, and I have learned a lot of lessons outside of COVID when I worked in humanitarian aid contexts, which is basically, you know, dealing with pandemic level type crises, not exactly the same, not global, but at national scale, et cetera, where education is deeply disrupted, kids' lives are disrupted. And so there's a lot of lessons there too. So what we can do differently is, I would say, a couple of things. One is in the preparation. Get a list of every family, have their phone numbers on file. The schools in the US who had good connections with their scholars, their students' families, and had trusting relationships so that families could tell them what was going on and schools could talk to them, did much better. They could quickly pivot because they knew who to call. They didn't have a relationship where every time the school called, a family thought it was because they were in trouble, so doesn't want to pick up the phone, mm-hmm. right? They had good, positive two-way communication, and they could problem solve together. When things weren't working, they could problem solve. So that's in the preparation. The second thing I think we can do, and we can do it now, and we can continue it, is really develop a whole community approach to learning. There's no reason that through service, through community service with a church or a mosque or at a park or with the city government's homeless outreach program or whatever it may be, that young people can't learn collaborative problem solving skills or can't learn to apply some of the science knowledge that they're learning in class. And that type of applied learning and learning these, you know, other sets of competence and skills that we want young kids to have does not have to happen inside the four walls of a classroom. So we can develop that ecosystem of partnerships. In some ways, it's a community schools approach. And that can happen now. And if COVID hits, you can sustain those partnerships and think of your community as the fabric of the classroom, where kids can explore and learn. Now, the third thing would be, of course, you need to maintain high quality instruction. And that is tough when kids aren't in front of you. But I think if COVID hit again, what we learned is you can't expect teachers to succeed and students to succeed by just doing what you would do in person through a digital medium. It's not going to work. It's not the same thing. So we will have to cull from all the good practices that are out there around online learning for high quality academic instruction, which kids will need. And there's lots of things you can do, but it would take investment in helping not only the digital infrastructure, but really helping our teachers figure out how to do things differently. And that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work, especially if they're home with their own kids too, right? Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the things that we learned in COVID.
Amazing stuff. And I also think that in your answer, definitely heard relationship building, the importance of having parents. But I do love the opportunity for kids to already begin to make these connections with these organizations, if you will, mm-hmm. to get credit for, to build for such a thing.
Yeah.
You guys, you and Jenny really hit on some things, talking about your book here a bit, that you want kids to have their own ideas so that they can be invested. And this sounds just like that. Am I going to have an opportunity to really have a buy-in? And this keeps me engaged. And we go back to that because I feel that when learners are invested, the role of engagement not only shifts, but it becomes a duality. The teacher is a student and vice versa. And we're working together hand in hand. Thank you. I mean, let's now talk about your book, which is going to drop January 7th. And I know that this is going to be a smash. I've already uploaded a link so that my listeners and platform can get an opportunity to purchase The Disengaged Teen, Helping Kids Learn Better, Feel Better, and Live Better. Tell us about that book and why is it so important for you and for Jen, who's not here with us today?
This book is really about why kids, especially when they hit adolescence, disengage from school, and what parents, educators, and ed leaders can do about it. That is at the core of the book. And one of the things, I would say three highlights, and then you can probe for more, as I know you always do, Jules. One is that kids are really, really not engaged in school the older they get. So this is a statistic that breaks my heart. It breaks my heart. When kids are in third grade, 75% of them say they love school. This is from a very large survey of kids in the US. And when they're in 10th grade, that's flipped. 25% of them say they love school. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the questions we asked on this survey. We partnered with a nonprofit, Transcend, to do a lot of the research for this book. And it's not the exact same thing as being engaged, but it's a pretty close proxy for it. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, what are we doing in school that makes kids hate school so much? The older they get, the longer they stay at a time. And it really shifts when kids go to middle school. You see a big drop middle school and high school. And that's the time of adolescence when their brains are on fire. There are all sorts of exciting developments are happening neurobiologically, physically, socially. They want to make connections. They want to understand meaning. They're like primed to get out and explore. And we somehow are shutting down their love of learning. And again, I do not think this is teachers who are bit squashed from the top in terms of ed standards and what they have to do every day, and pressure from the bottom by pressure from parents. So that's takeaway number one, that it's bad. Kids are disengaged the older they get. Takeaway number two is it's really hard for adults, parents, educators, to really see the full depth of student engagement. We can see what kids do, which is how they show up. Do they do their homework? Do they disrupt class? Do they follow instructions? And that's one component of engagement. But we know that there's many other dimensions that make kids really lean in and be motivated and excited and engaged in their learning. One is how they feel about school. Are they interested? Do they feel they belong? Do they feel safe? Another is how they think. Are they making connections to what they're learning in one class, to what they've heard in a past class or in their lives? And then a fourth dimension is how proactive are they? in terms of going out and initiating activities that would help them learn better because they're more interested or they're getting support. That could be asking for help. That could be pursuing something they're super interested in. So that's a second point. And then the third point is, in order to really help kids become more engaged, we realized that, and when I say more engaged, across the full dimensions of engagement, we realized that one of the barriers was that parents and educators couldn't really see and spot when kids were beginning to disengage. And so we had to develop a new language, a new framework, a new language. So we developed these four modes of engagement that came out of all our research, which is we found that kids show up in four different ways. They're in passenger mode, they're coasting, they are participating. So they may be getting good grades or they may be struggling, but they're there, they're not disruptive, they're participating. There's achiever mode. These are the kids who are giving it their all. They want to succeed in school by the school measures. And this is great. Many times it's great. The problem is kids, if they are stuck in achiever mode, there's often a downside to it. Not always, but often, which is they become very afraid of failing and they become very fragile learners. So they don't take risks. And if they do fail, they start thinking they themselves as a person are not worthwhile versus they just made a mistake. And they do have, they can have quite severe mental health problems. And then the third mode is kids who are in resistor mode. These everybody knows. All families know, all teachers know, these are your quote unquote problem children, as Dr. Amy Berry says, rather than children with problems. And the thing that kids in resistor mode have that kids in passenger mode and achiever mode don't have is they do have agency because they are telling us with whatever voice they're able to use. And it often comes out inappropriately, like not doing homework, skipping class, having outbursts, but those are all ways to voice, this isn't working for me, mom, dad, educator, principal, this setup is not working for me. And we found that if you can shift the environment that those kids are in, they pretty quickly go from pointing their agency away from school and learning to school and learning. Now, it sometimes takes moving classes, it sometimes takes moving peer groups, it sometimes takes moving to a different type of schooling experience altogether. It often takes, counterintuitively, giving them more freedom, not less freedom. So that's resistor mode. And then the pinnacle is really explorer mode, where kids are deeply engaged. They're, you know, in terms of what they do, what they feel, what they think, but they're also the one mode that's really proactively initiating things that help them learn better. Can I write my essay on this? I'm super interested in it. Hey, can I do this project with a friend? I want to use YouTube for this. Can I do that? This proactivity is agency. And the more agency we were just talking about it, kids have, the more they feel they own it and it becomes more interesting to them. So they get more excited. And then there's also this, as you said, this dual reciprocal relationship with teachers. Teachers see the kids getting super lit up and being more proactive. So they give them more freedom and give them extra work and, you know, more opportunities, and that makes them even more excited. And it's just this virtuous upward cycle in explore mode. And, our research showed that less than 10% of kids, third to 12th grade, reported that they regularly get a chance to do this type of proactive exploring in school.
Girl, look, you and Jenny just dropped gems on this. funny enough, I'm just sitting here visualizing, because my job as an administrator many times is to sit in the student seat and understand where they are coming from. And I just want to relive these moments. There was just so much that you talked about. The resistor mode is, how can we understand what is the power that you're going to let me have if, if like things are not working? When you think about the passenger mode, you know, coasting, and I'm just doing the bare minimum. And we'll get into more of that through these beautiful stories that you guys interviewed students and families. The achiever mode, atop the engagement pedestal, motivated, but there's always room for some improvement. There's some areas. And then when you are in the explorer mode, you build these skills that can help you thrive. But what I really enjoyed about your book early on, what I saw was that you thoroughly said, although you can have this package, you're still going to want more, because the word you use, the proactive piece, am I going to use this skill outside of my school domain? And that is where I think your book lives. And it's so incredible. I cannot wait to keep reading through it, because what I caught early on was, if I'm in a situation as a parent, you better believe I have a say. There's a lot that I can do. And just because my son or daughter is texting every time I'm talking to them, they're not paying attention, please believe those antennas are up. And that energy that you are forecasting, letting out for them, is obviously there. I always tell teachers, be mindful of when a resistor is near you. Because if you're going to say, yeah, she doesn't really try, you know, her reading levels are low. You know, what is she good at? What are the things that she can probably bring? So I really, really want people to take advantage of this incredible encyclopedia, because this is what this is giving you a shot to look at every possible angle that you guys have really researched and did an incredible job in making it able for us and tangible for us to see from any viewpoint, as a parent, as a student, as a teacher, and so on. So big up to you and Jenny, because this was incredible. For me, I'm saying to you now, as I was looking at this and what I thought was so insightful, early on, Dominican boy, Mateo, who is in one of your learning modes. And as the passenger, he's like the parent inside of the home, because he has a translator to help parents do things. When you were able to see these stories as you guys were putting this together, now the modes are hitting and all these things are happening. Tell me about the reaction that you and Jenny were having. Like, was it a oh my God moment? Like, what was that like as you were going through this and this was really happening right before your eyes?
Right. Well, we had the great privilege, and I really do mean it, to be able to interview close to 100 young people all across the country and also in England, where Jenny lives. And they let us into their lives. A number of them we interviewed multiple times as they were going through their journeys. And I think the thing that really hit us the most is how logical and pragmatic kids' decisions are. There's nothing wrong with our kids. Our kids are great. And you gave the story of Mateo. Mateo, had come from the DR, lived in Providence. And he talks about, you know, he was the youngest of the three and academically inclined, and his family's hopes were on him. His other brothers, were not as devoted to school. And so he really was sort of the pillar of helping his parents. He learned English really quickly. He was the go-to, as many kids are. In his situation, for all sorts of things. He would help pay the bills. He'd do the budget. He would translate. He did all sorts of things. And he as he grew up and he started in middle school, he wasn't challenged, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He was bored because classes were just too easy for him. And he was very academically inclined. And he had this one class, he told us about this one class, I laughed so hard. He had a math teacher who said, you can get unlimited extra credit for doing, you know, there was like a point in exercise in an online math app. So he said he went home, he calculated, like he did his own math, how much points would he need not to do any homework the entire year and just do the math app. And that's what he did. And he got an A. And he was like, I can't believe they let me do that. Mm-hmm. He didn't do any homework. He got an A. So this kid was bored out of his gourd. And he was a social kid. And he just was looking for something to do to entertain himself. And so he started being class clown. He started acting out. So he started sneaking out of class just because he was so bored. And then it led to him skipping school regularly. And his parents didn't know what was what, because he would lie to them. The teachers would call home. So-and-so wasn't in class, etc. And it's not like he was going off to do anything crazy. He would literally skip school and go sit with his friends on the playground.
Mm-hmm.
So he was there, and eventually teachers, you know, he got caught. I know what it was. One day they just got super hungry, and so they tried to come back to school for lunch, and people saw him. And then he really did get caught. And so he eventually made his way into a learning environment that challenged him and gave him real opportunities to grow and gave him choice about what he was interested in. And from there he flew, ended up getting a scholarship when he graduated high school for a full ride to become a computer scientist from Amazon. And so he just needed a different learning environment. There was nothing wrong with him. And when you think about, if you saw him on paper, he would be a kid who skips class. He would be a kid who acts out. He would be a kid who doesn't follow directions. You know, he would be headed towards real problems, and he was a problem kid, you know, like, but when he talks about what his day was like, you kind of understand why he made those decisions. So that is, you know, that's our challenge as people who care about and want to help shape and guide young people. How do we, when we're dealing, especially you have many, many students every day, how do you help see and spot what mode kids are in, so we know how to support them? Because when your kids are in different modes, they need different supports.
I am fascinated that you, just like me, do not look at the referral about what the kid looks like on paper. I allow the student to come in, and I pride myself in making connections with every student. And funny enough, I can tell you 700 plus students, is interesting how many names I know. But not only that, the amount of connections that I've made with the parents. So they don't know if I'm calling for good news or bad news.
Which is amazing. And amazing.
You have hit on a point of when a parent is notified, and coming from a Latino background as myself, we are only called in for maybe a suspension, some sort of, you know, accountability on something was missing or so on, behavior. And then every 3-4 years, a graduation. We need to engage parents in different ways. And I think that you guys hit this in this book in ways to involve parents, the strategies and the tips that you guys have provided to show parents their worth. And that's why this book is so, so amazing. In so many ways, education and beyond. Talk a little bit about the challenges. Working with Jenny, probably not the challenge, but I think more around how difficult was it for you to guys to say, this is our angle. Did you have to change your scheme?
Mm.
And how was that?
Oh my gosh, Jules. if Jenny was here, we would both be laughing. Because we started out, it took us 3 years to write, first off. I mean, we did do a lot of research. We had great research partners. but we changed a lot along the journey. We started out as a school design book of what is it that schools could do to really help kids flourish and engage. And then we thought, well, how is that going to help someone reading this unless they're a school leader? Mm. Like, parents don't have access to most of these incredible schools. And they're not in your position to really shift what happens inside the building. And you're not even in a position to totally revamp how school is even designed, right? Mm-hmm. So we thought, well, what if we flipped it? And we saw so much evidence about how three things really, but it was how much power parents and caregivers and families have in motivating and supporting their kids' engagement in school. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it makes sense because, you know, parents aren't professionally trained teachers. They may not be able to, you know, really help with, you know, algebra homework or, excuse me, you know, history, et cetera, but they can sure instill a love of learning in their kids and that school is important and help them develop their voice and their agency and some of these learning to learn skills like organization and stuff. So parents are hugely powerful. In fact, what parents do at home is 2 times more predictive of school engagement and achievement than socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. So it's available to every parent. You don't have to hire tutors or be wealthy. It can be any parent. So that's where we really flipped and said, what if we wrote this for what parents can do at home, how they can work with educators at school, and then, of course, what educators can take.
I am so glad you guys went through this change and made this happen, because early in your book, just even in the intro section, you are understanding the role of engagement, but you're also understanding the gift that every student, that every person involved in your educational trek is capable of. And that was what really hit home for me, that everyone has a role. We all play part of this. Like when you hear parents sometimes telling students, you know, I gave you the support that you needed, you know, it's not really about being there to be tough. It was really understanding, this is how my kid understands more. How can I play a role during my downtime, a home time with my child, mm-hmm. to let him or her understand that what they're doing is going to be useful in real life.
Yeah.
That piece of engagement is going to come through. What are some of the tips that you may have here for teachers who open up your book and say, okay, I see some things here. What are some of those tips?
Yeah. Well, we have an engagement toolkit in the book that parents and educators can use. Mm-hmm. And it really is organized based on if kids get stuck in either passenger mode, resistor mode, or achiever mode, what can you help to do to unstick them? Mm-hmm. And so they often need slightly different things. So if a kid is in passenger mode, a lot of times what they need that parents can help with and teachers too, is they need basic organization, learning to learn skills. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I learned that I thought was so fascinating is, you know, the coasting kids who come home, they procrastinate their homework, they might do it at the very end and rush through it. They often are procrastinating because there's a negative emotion associated with the homework. They're stressed about it. They don't know where to begin. They don't quite understand it. They can't quite remember what they're supposed to do. It could be a range of things. And so when we nag as parents, do your homework. You didn't do your homework. Do your homework again. Have you done your homework? It like exacerbates the negative emotion and kind of shuts down the part of the brain that is where problem solving is supposed to happen. So it makes it worse. Mm-hmm. And really what we should be doing is you know, doing the homework is on the kid, on the kids. You want to monitor, you want to surveil if you're a parent, and surveil in terms of like, make sure everything's going okay, but not sit there and force them to do it or do it directly with them. But you can help them make a plan, figure out where they get stuck, help them think about if that strategy worked that day or if they should try a new strategy. So you can really, we go through sort of, you know, moving the procrastination nagging cycle into a learning to learn cycle. So that's one thing if kids are in passenger mode, and I could go on for the other modes if you want, but you looked like you wanted to jump in.
No, this is your show, and I'm just delighted to keep hearing all these gems that you keep dropping. Take us away.
So when kids are really stuck in resistor mode, you do have to figure out why and get to the bottom of it, rather than immediately punish the behavior. And that's not saying don't have consequences for kids who act out, or, you know, skip school, et cetera. Kids need consequences. They need clear guidelines and expectations for behavior. But before you jump in, you're grounded, you know, I'm taking away your privileges, et cetera. What is the reason why they are resisting? What is it? Because we found that there's always something at the bottom there. And that is what you need to address. It could be kids were bullied terribly. It could be kids had really struggled with mental health issues, deep anxiety. It could be that kids had undiagnosed learning differences and really needed special help. It could be that kids got so far behind academically that they became totally overwhelmed. We talked to multiple kids who had sort of in several classes had missed core components of their academic learning that they just couldn't catch up. And, you know, these are 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds. And they said, well, I'm getting D's in three classes and an F, and I guess it's all over for me. I guess I'll never catch up and I'll never go to college. I never will have this life I wanted for myself. They really were so overwhelmed. They thought it was all over for them. Mm-hmm. And of course it isn't. It's like, nope, you can recover. You can do summer school. You can ask for help. You know, there's many strategies if we spot it. So you really have to get to the bottom of what it is and remove those impediments. And then you also, the other thing, I have a lot to say about kids in resistor mode, because actually they're, if you can just surround them with the right environment and supports, they will take off. The other thing not to do is to take away any of their passions or interests or extracurriculars. We are guilty of this as parents. We are guilty of this as schools. You are not doing well in your classes. You're sliding academically. Okay, no more soccer, no more band, no more, you can't take part in math lab, you can't do the science fair, you can't. And actually, kids in resistor mode need that more than anything. They need something interesting and exciting. They need a spot where they can shine, where they can be the one who is good at something. And that sort of spark and interest spills over and is this sort of, it spills over to the rest of school eventually. So, don't take away their interests, but fuel them, support them, give them other types of disciplinary things. We have a great character who we interviewed, who was this incredible young man who, basically got kicked out of high school freshman year. He got suspended and expelled so many times that they eventually like, you just can't come back. Mm-hmm. And his parents never took away his love of architecture. He had a total passion for architecture at home. So he would be skipping school, acting out, not whatever. He was one of a small handful of Black kids in an all-white school, which had something to do with it. And at home, he would study and do architecture and make his own plans, and they would talk to him about it over Sunday barbecues, and then they would take him to open houses and drive him around and talk to him about it. This is while he's, like, you know, not behaving well. They would discipline him in other ways. They would take away phones. They would take away, you know, fun birthday privileges. They would take away family, friend time, bicycles, you know. But they didn't ever take away his passion. And they always told him, you know, you have something special. And he held on to that for many years until when the principal said, you know, you can't come back, but why don't you try this other program? He went to a program called Iowa Big, mm-hmm. Which is a school where it's a program across several districts in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where kids go to school part-time for their core classes, but most of the time they are working on applying their knowledge that they learned to real world problems. And the very first project his Iowa Big School gave him when he showed up, they said, you know, you seem to like architecture. We need to redesign our common room, our gathering room, our assembly. Could you be in charge of it? And he literally within a month turned around. He was like the glowing student, and he just took off from there and, you know, was a rock star. He, you know, he talked about feeling like he was in an airtight container and couldn't really breathe when he was in his traditional school. And when he went to Iowa Big, all of a sudden there was an abundance of air and he could breathe deeply. And, you know, he went on and got a scholarship to university and was a double major in business and sociology, and is, you know, one of the youngest members of Iowa's Cedar Rapids African American Museum, and works in a clean energy company, and, you know, he's doing great.
I tell you, such a remarkable story, so much to unpack. This debate about homework, obviously, parents, is homework just review of what they learned in the day so they can retain? Is homework not challenging enough? You guys don't give homework. What is going on there? So there's so much to look at that. You go back to the resistor and you listen to the stories. Please do not ever sleep on the underdog. You brought early on a story about Kia, who was flourishing early. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, boom, needed her spot when she was in 10th grade at some point. Say, hey, I have something to say. I got a story to tell how you can make school better. Mm-hmm. We have to bring that passion back. I can tell you myself, I wasn't good in high school. I never went to high school. I had to get my GED. Mm-hmm. And you could put me in that book as well, because I always struggled because school was different for me. I always found myself to be smart, or at least able to complete the things I needed and pass standardized tests, which is a different thing. But what was not prevalent when I was coming up that these guys are dealing with is mental health. Mm-hmm. Guys hit on the amount of depression, anxiety, and clinical diagnoses, aside from learning diagnoses, that students have to come across. What surprised you and Jenny as you were interviewing students hitting on this? Because most times we find that putting a student sometimes in speech and language or getting special education is the answer. And we soon find it's not that. It's just a communication piece that's coming in for this, you know, second language learner. What was you and Jenny thinking as you were looking at these cases? And now, the book aside, you were like, oh my God, we are seeing things that we've never seen before. How was that for you guys?
One of the things that really struck us, and we were, you know, pretty far through midway through interviews, like 50 kids. That's a lot. That's a lot of kids. And we were like, wow, almost everyone has some moment in their life when they really struggle with their mental health and well-being. And we weren't out seeking kids who were, you know, had mental health struggles. We literally, you know, paused midway through just to check our sample, make sure we're getting, you know, race and gender and age and demographics and kids who are neurodivergent and, you know, hitting a bunch of perspectives, mental health. And then we were like, oh my gosh, almost every single one of these stories from kids who are in achiever mode, doing great at elite private schools, who really, really melted down the minute they got into college, and there were signs of it. They were cracking, and they just couldn't get off the treadmill to ask for help, and they thought it was a sign of weakness, all the way to kids who really were in very, very dark places, and really, and struggled with suicidal ideation and suicide attempt, like the, you know, in public schools and everywhere and everyone in between. And so it is something that young people are really struggling with and facing. It's real. And, you know, I'm happy to report all of them have come through it. And I think all of them are much more self-aware because of it, but it certainly derailed their trajectories pretty heavily in some cases.
We, you know, shout you and Jenny out again for just bringing these stories up to light. When you talk about mental health, you guys hone in on so many pieces. Let's talk about feedback. You researched how different it is when someone is receiving feedback and the way or style, the amount of words that are used in feedback, how that can impact. And you now shared an achiever never got nothing wrong or probably never struggled. And all of a sudden, hey, this is not correct. What? These are the different things that really come up. Tell us about feedback and how relevant it is to the outcome of a student moving forward.
Yeah, this is research from David Yeager and his colleagues who really found that if you give kids feedback, let's say they're doing a short essay, and you give them feedback and give them critique, you know, here, you know, try to improve this, strengthen your topic sentence, you know, your grammar's off, whatever it is, and say you can revise the paper, you know, in whatever period of time and improve your grade. And if you give feedback, same critique, same comments, and at the top say, I'm giving you this feedback because I have high expectations and I believe in you. I know you can meet them. Mm. The kids who got that message were much more likely to revise and put the work in and improve their grade because they needed to know that someone had their back and that they had potential, and they weren't just given this feedback because they were bad and wrong. It was really about the connection and the respect and the belief in their potential that makes the difference. And kids saw themselves differently too. It makes a huge difference.
You are speaking my language. You are talking to a provider who, like a parent, slips notes in kids' backpacks, my IEP kids and my kids who are in academic assistance, telling them how they can use the strategy that they learn to build, to write an equation and use it in science and write a little post-it that they'll find inside their backpack, inside of their book, telling them you got this, just like you did this other problem. These are the kind of messages that change how students feel and that works for you and how they think.
Yes.
And this is why this is such a gem. This is going to be a smash. I am so excited for you and Jen, but this has really been a treat for us to really understand and unpack just a little. A show would not be enough to really hone in into the gifts that you have shared within this book. Amazing stuff. What do you want readers to get from your book? And when they get it, like, what do you want them to really look at and say, hey, this is something that I want you guys to really think about when you do my book?
I really hope that if you're a parent or caregiver of a young person, you read it, even if you think your kid is doing pretty well in school, because they're probably in achiever mode, and there's a tendency to think that achiever mode is the top when really explore mode is the top. Mm-hmm. I want parents to read it and think about where they see their kids at. And their kids can move between modes across the years or across the months and even across the day. And I want them, parents and caregivers, to really feel how powerful they are in supporting their kids to get into explore mode. And I would absolutely have the same hope for educators who read it.
You've shared with us some incredible stories, your toolkit, so many things, and you've reached and seen so much around the world. Is there a person, a story that you connect with from time to time, a bit all of this that you've seen and probably wrote about, that really touches you and says, you know what, today, no matter how I feel to resist this, I'm going to go out here and fight for this student case. Mm. Is there such?
Well, one, that is hard because I actually hold a soft spot in my heart for every kid we talk to. But there is one story that really always touches me when I talk to him or think about it, which is a young man named Samir, who was in the Talented and Gifted program in elementary school, son of Indian immigrants. And for some unknown reason, when he switched to middle school, he was no longer in the Talented and Gifted program. Mm. And all his friends were in Talented and Gifted program. And he all of a sudden realized, you know, what happened? Was I talented and brilliant and gifted and had all this enriched learning experiences? And, you know, 3 months later through summer vacation, all of a sudden I'm not. And that sent him in a downward spiral like no other. He thought he had failed. He thought he was no good. He had no friends. He sat alone at lunch the whole time because the kids in the Talented and Gifted program, when they went to middle school, were in a different, had a different schedule. Mm-hmm. And it was a really, really hard journey for him. He became incredibly depressed, missed oodles of school. But he came out the other side as a social, fighting for social justice. He was like, wait a minute. It took him a while to realize that part of the way you get into the Talented and Gifted program is parents make a recommendation for their kids to be assessed. Mm-hmm. And his mom had no idea that she was supposed to do that. If a principal hadn't, you know, done that, I think, you know, in the middle school, and he just really eventually came into his own and got onto the student rep on the school board, fought for equal treatment for all students. And he's went to community college. He's on track to transfer to University of Virginia, and he wants to become a public defender. And it shaped him in his life. And he rose to the challenge at the end of the day with a lot of supports from school social workers who changed his life, Jules.
That's right.
Like you change lives every day, changed his life, the school social worker, because she saw him and she believed in him. And she didn't say, how are you going to make up all this work you've missed? At one point he missed, you know, I don't know, like 4 months of school, which is what other adults had said. Instead, she said, why aren't you coming to school? She just asked why. And that's all I needed.
Wow. What a touching story. And here applying a real life skill, because we all have gifts. And he so happened to have more than one. And this really unpacked that for him. Friend, before we let you go, the floor is yours. Tell us something you want our platform and our listeners to remember about you, next steps for you and Jenny, the book.
Thank you. Please, please, please go and order the book at thedisengagedteen.com. And it's out on January 7th. It's available for pre-order now. If you do pre-order, go to our websites, put in your name and email and confirmation number, and we will send you some content that isn't in the book, the chapters that were cut around tips for teachers in particular and tips for parents around supporting students belonging in school. So yeah, and then let us know. We always appreciate Amazon reviews, reviews on Goodreads. That is incredibly helpful for this work to get it out there. So any engagement is much appreciated.
Thank you so much. I have uploaded a link to your book on my website as well. And here we are owning our own ideas and just thinking about the ways that as teachers, we also are students and we're here to learn. Thank you for such a great show. Remember, friends, that your dreams are uniquely yours. Never let others diminish the value of your visions. Your dreams, they serve as your compass to where you've been and where you plan to go next. Keep on dreaming. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Rebecca, thank you so much for such a lovely show.
Thank you, Jules.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.